Well, hello there.
Sorry. Looking for the glasses case that Mark left behind.
Yeah, wasn't here, though.
No.
No.
Nice try, though.
Hey, so my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we got a sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located up at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they can take care of pretty much any of your John Deere needs, whether it be small ag, big ag, turf, you name it, they can handle it. If they can't get it for you, one of their many stores can. So go up and talk to them or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There we go.
Nice.
So, what's going on with the show today?
Well, we have two guests today. We don't always have two guests.
No.
It's kind of a fun switch up. Two guests we've never... But you know what? I think I'm lying. I was going to say two guests we've never spoken with, but I think we have spoken with Lawrence Mead. He's in the second hour. His name was familiar, but I never went back and looked. We'll have to ask him. He'll be like, I remember you guys.
Yeah, you chuckleheads.
But Dr. Lee Gross is new to us. He's the president of Docs for Patient Care Foundation and the owner of Epiphany Health. So he has written an article. I think we're supposed to call it a piece.
Yes.
They always call it. It's not an article. They don't write articles anymore. They write pieces.
Yes.
The public option is the wrong approach to healthcare reform. Yes. And that sort of, I mean, he wrote more than that, but I think at that point I was a fan.
Yeah, you're hooked.
Yeah. So our friend, Stephen.
Not a big public option fan, I take it.
No. What could go wrong? Okay.
Well, I just think the government, taking care of our health care is a great idea.
I mean, when you look, the more involved they get, the better they
absolutely,
do.
Absolutely, yeah. Get their hands
in all they can. I think
everybody
finds that. The more the government gets involved in their life, the easier it becomes.
Absolutely.
More streamlined, too.
And cheaper.
Yeah. Okay, so now we've identified the pitfalls. But I should give credit. Our two guests come to us from the Manfredi Strategy Group, our friend Stephen Manfredi back there in Virginia.
Yeah.
He fires me off an email. Hey, want to interview so-and-so? It's like, yep, because we always learn interesting things. So, Dr. Gross, are you in there?
I am.
Nice.
Oh.
How are you?
Well, great. We're glad to have you today. This a topic I think everybody needs to learn a little bit more about.
Yeah, anybody who's still deluded about the public option, you're going to help them with that, right?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Nothing. The government is so awesome at doing everything.
Yeah, because we all got to keep our doctor and have cheaper health care now. So,
who wouldn't like that?
Absolutely.
So where would you like to take the train off the tracks?
Oh my goodness, we can start with your introduction about the government making things cheaper, more efficient.
Epic fail.
I think we're seeing right now in terms of. You know, when you let your government make healthcare decisions for you, how that works out for the general public. You know, when the government wants to take a one-size-fits-all approach to healthcare, and you don't happen to fit into that one size they want to put you into, it doesn't work out too well for the individual patients, and certainly doesn't work out for the individual doctors, that, again, don't want to sort of fall in line with you know, whatever it is that the government interests are in that particular
I remember
so
when
all unfolding in front of us.
Yeah, I remember when Obamacare took effect. I mean, there were doctors all over town that actually put signs on their counters, we don't accept certain health care plans. And I think this is why.
Absolutely. You know, so what Obamacare did was it just increased the complexity, it increased the cost of everything, and it made it so difficult for physician practices to comply that it just drove them out of private practice and into the larger consolidation by the hospitals and healthcare corporations. In essence, it basically just decreased choice and increased the cost. And then the government went around and either did one of two things, either put people into Medicaid, which squeezed the truly needy out of the market because you couldn't access the doctors because there weren't enough doctors now, or put them into an insurance product that had, you know, an $8,000 deductible, which basically means you had a card, but you couldn't use it anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the whole Medicare or Medicaid thing, a lot of doctors don't take that because they just don't pay enough to, you know, cover their costs, basically.
Tremendous bureaucracy, and absolutely right. There's, you know, just so many hoops and headaches to jump through. And then the amount of paperwork and regulatory work and risks for audits and running afoul of the very complex rules, and then you factor in that complexity with, you know, a tremendously low physician fee schedule, makes it very difficult to keep your lights on.
Well, mm-hmm. And then they decide what you can prescribe for people. They get in the middle of that. So if you can get the people through the door, you can bill it in a way that lets you operate. Then when you try to treat them, the government still is deciding whether or not, you know, your medical school.
They're the real doctors.
Yeah.
Sure. So I'm a family doctor in Southwest Florida. Okay. And I've been in practice now for about 20 years. So I've seen this pendulum swinging back and forth over the course of my career and through my years prior to medical school. And I am now in a practice where I don't accept any insurance whatsoever. I don't accept Medicaid. I'm opted out of Medicare, and I have patients that come to my practice from all over the state of Florida. So I have patients that drive 3-4 hours away, and I'll sort of share our practice model with you. But, you know, for the first 10 years of my practice, I ran in a traditional fee-for-service practice where I was contracted with all the insurances. I accepted Medicaid. I was in the Medicare system, and I would constantly have to fly up to Washington and beg for my life, as the Washington brinksmanship nearly put me out of business. Mm. You know, so when you're getting into these debates over debt ceilings and funding of the government, keep in mind that these physicians and these medical practices are funded by this money. And so when the brinksmanship takes it to the point where they're saying, okay, we're going to stop payment, we're going to close the government, that means that medical practices no longer receive payment. That means that, you know, physicians are taking out personal loans to make payroll to their staff.
Yeah.
And what we realized in that first 10 years of my practice is the government was a very unreliable partner in business. The politics behind absolutely everything made it so it was almost impossible for us to plan for our budgets. We had no idea how much money we were going to get paid, when we were going to get paid. And so one day we had a small business owner that came up to my practice and he said, you know what, my insurance premiums keep skyrocketing. All my employees see you as their doctor. Why don't I just contract with you directly? Because I see what I pay the insurance companies, and I see what they pay you, and somebody here is getting screwed.
Yeah.
And so we had an epiphany. That's the name of my practice, is Epiphany Health. The epiphany is, why are we using insurance to pay for primary care? Why are we inserting so many obstacles and barriers and filing an insurance claim for absolutely every single transaction that happens between a doctor and patient? And then we're upset that it's impersonal, that it's very expensive and cumbersome. So we created a subscription-based practice, just like Netflix. This was 10 years ago. We charge less than the cost of a cell phone for as low as $65 a month for an adult and as low as $10 a month for a child. We provide unlimited services in our offices with no copays, no deductibles, unlimited technology visits, unlimited procedures, and in-office testing.
Right.
And so that has drawn patients without insurance and with bad insurance and with government insurance and with Medicaid from all over the state of Florida to get care in our practice because they can afford that.
Right, right. Yeah, and you look at what the insurance premiums are for most folks, and it's a heck of a lot more than $65 a month. So I could see where that would be a real cost savings. Now, the plan you're talking about now is for just general health care. You would still need to have insurance if you wanted any kind of major coverage. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let insurance be insurance again. Let it be a hedge against an unexpected loss, not a fully funded prepaid health plan. And so what we find is that even things that you don't predict are actually more affordable if you pay cash for them than if you use insurance. So what we found is that our patients with insurance that had high deductibles or our uninsured patients needed affordable access to imaging services, laboratory services. And so what we did was we contracted with these labs. And we just bought everything wholesale. We said, you know, if our patients agree to pay you cash at the time of service, what can you sell us these services for? And almost every single situation, the cash price was cheaper than the responsibility using insurance. So if I pull out my insurance card, my cost out of pocket for an MRI is $500, but the cash price is $220.
Yeah.
So what are we insuring if the insurance, if using that insurance doubles your out-of-pocket cost?
Right.
And so what we found is that even surgeries can be less expensive paying cash than using insurance. So what we find there are things that are unaffordable, are actually quite affordable once you take the insurance out of the equation. So the insurance truly does become for, you know, the major medical, the cancers, the heart attacks, the bypass surgeries.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, you look at, I mean, speaking for myself, you take older folks, maybe they have some, you know, pre-existing conditions. For a couple, you're going to pay $800-$900 a month for an insurance policy with a pretty stiff deductible. And the plan you're talking about, you could save, well, and then also if you do have to buy like a major medical plan, that's a lot cheaper than a plan that's going to cover, you know, runny noses and everything else. I mean, just your major medical isn't, I mean, it's still expensive, but it's not near as much as a plan that covers everything. So I can see where your plan would save people a considerable amount of money.
It absolutely does. And so what we did here in Florida is we were approached by a rural hospital in the second poorest county in the state of Florida. So this is not a wealthy community. It's a relatively underserved community. And they wanted to restructure their employee health plan. And they wanted to allow all of their employees that wanted to sign up for our program to do so at no cost. So the hospital agreed for their employees to sign up to our practice, and the hospital would pay them back for it. We're now 3 years into that. In the first year, we saved the hospital $1.2 million in their health plan costs,
wow,
which was a 54% reduction in the entire health plan costs. And in doing so, we eliminated the deductibles for these patients. So it cost them nothing to access the doctor.
Wow.
And then we restructured their plan in such a way that if they had anything done at the hospital itself, it was free to the employee. So if they had an MRI, it cost them nothing. If they had surgery, it cost them nothing. And as far as the regulations on our practice, the hospital made it very easy for us to practice, and they basically said, look, we trust you. You are a physician. You are the highest trained person in this entire chain of this health plan. So why would we hire somebody else that has less training to oversee and double check your work? We trust you. So that means if I order an MRI, it's covered. If I make a referral, it's covered. If I recommend a medication, it's covered. They trust us. So there's no reason for our practice to spend all this time fighting the bureaucracy to get things approved, to get things covered. It simply was done. And in doing so, by opening up and eliminating barriers, eliminating regulatory barriers, eliminating financial barriers, you would think that it would have opened up everything to access and people would have flooded the system with demand and it would have bankrupted them. But in the process, it did the exact opposite. It saved the plan 54% in the first year. And year number two, it did better than year number one. And year number three, we're doing better than year number two.
Wow. So why do you think it's taken so long to switch the thinking of people? And well, you got the big insurance guys that are selling insurance naturally, but why haven't more people caught on to this?
So they have, and they are. When we started this over 10 years ago, there were about a dozen of us independently working across the country in our little silos, and we didn't really know about each other. Fast forward now, and through the work of my foundation, we've trained over 1,000 physicians in the practice model, and we have over 2,000 independent practices now up and operating in this practice model, which is known as direct primary care. So if you wanted to do a web search for direct primary care, you'd find a practice probably right near you. We're operating in all 50 states with independent practices.
Hmm. That's pretty handy.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, we have an addiction in this country to insurance. We think that coverage is health care. Coverage is not health care. I think Obamacare has proven that giving somebody a card does not mean they have access to health care.
Yeah, that's true. And I do think that people got that exactly backwards. The other thing, maybe when we come back, like my particular physician is not part of any health plan, and so he has a lot more latitude than many. He can, you know, accept coverage if he wants. They bill it, but they're not part of the system. Like they can bill Blue Shield for me, but they're not part of the Blue Shield network. So when we come back, you know, decode that for us too. I don't know how that actually works, but that sort of helps the people who do have coverage through their work. And I don't know. I think it helps my doctor, too, at the end of the day, because he gets paid and I get reimbursed. So
sure.
We will come right back. Our guest is Dr. Lee Gross. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
And we're back. Okay, so the $64,000 question. You have insurance through your workplace, and it isn't the hospital like those guys have. And they want to go to you as their doctor. Can you bill for them?
So in our particular practice, we do not bill on a fee-for-service basis, but what employers, there are several different ways employers can get involved in this if they want to. So employers can fund a health reimbursement arrangement. So if the employee goes and shops for this, the employer can reimburse them for it. It's tax-free to the employer. It's tax-free to the employee. You can use health savings accounts for these sorts of things, which, again, employers and employees can contribute tax-free and pay for them. You can use flexible spending accounts. So if an employee wants to dedicate certain amounts of money at the beginning of the year tax-free towards medical spending, they can sign up for these as well. Plus, if you do other, you know, non-traditional insurance type things, so if your employer is self-funded through insurance, then they can create what's called an ERISA plan that's built around the practice model as well. So they can just build it directly into the structure of the health plan for the employer. So there are lots of ways that employers can integrate this sort of thing through it. Again, whether it's just reimbursed directly by the employer or whether it's paid directly by the employee, but there are certainly plenty of ways for it to be done.
Interesting.
So they would participate in your plan, but then would they also have a secondary plan for the majors?
Yeah, so if it's an employer-sponsored health plan, then you're bound by all the rules that affect employers at the state and federal level. So you'd still have to have major medical coverage for hospitalizations and drugs and preventive services outside of the direct primary care offices. All those things would still have to be covered. Just like it would be for any other business. What we find is that direct primary care gives you, it eliminates a lot of the financial barriers to accessing care. It also gives more personalized time. So if if any of your listeners have gone to a physician lately, you'll know that the doctor is very rushed. Most of the time is spent with their face in the computer clicking boxes. The office visit is probably, 7 minutes long, and of those 7 minutes, 3 minutes, maybe actually the doctor talking to you and listening to your problems. But the rest of the time is spent trying to build the encounter and to do an interaction which satisfies the rules of the federal government, Medicare, Medicaid, and the insurance companies in order for them to get paid.
Hmm.
Those don't happen in a direct primary care practice because our computer systems aren't cash registers. They're not. Our office visits are not designed to extract as much money out of the patient's insurance company as possible and to repeat it as many times as possible. That's not how it's done. And so the employee or the patient does not have to wonder, if they have enough money to actually see the doctor for this particular problem and how much it's going to cost me. So, for example, let's say you go see the doctor for a physical with your traditional insurance. Now, as you know, most physicals have to be free. It's a preventive service, and under the law, it's required that there's no cost sharing for that. No deductibles apply. But if you go into your doctor's visit and you say, "Oh, doc, by the way, since I took the day off of work, my knee's been bothering me." Well, all of a sudden, that's no longer a physical. That's now an evaluation and management of a knee pain problem. And it's now billed as two separate visits, and you receive it, and the second one actually applies towards your deductible, and you get a surprise $200 bill in the mail. That creates animosity between the doctor and the patient. and creates it, it looks like the doctor billed it wrong or the doctor's taking advantage. But in fact, the system is so broken that it creates barriers and obstacles between the doctor and patient where they can't be honest with each other and share the problems that are actually going on in their lives that really will have, effectively have meaning for them.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see where that
would
be.
Didn't even think about that.
Bad issue. You mentioned prescriptions. What about medications under your plan?
So most of the direct primary care practices in the country dispense medications wholesale directly from their practices. So much like Sam's Club and BJ's and Costco, the warehouse clubs, they can sell things at less price because they make their money on the memberships. The same thing with our practices. We make our revenue off of our membership, so we do not need to charge extra retail for our prescriptions. So we can dispense whole generic medications at pennies on the dollar. So in almost all situations, our prescriptions are cheaper than the pharmacy, they're cheaper than Walmart, because, you know, there's no retail markup with that. The name brand medications are still very expensive. There's really nothing you can do about that in the direct primary care practice, but you can manage diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol for probably less than $5 a month.
Yeah, that's a substantial savings.
And that's the stuff that people are dealing with for the most part. So I'm assuming it's kind of like homeschool. You guys kind of remind me of the homeschool for medical, you know. Is the government coming for you to try to squeeze you out now that you found this, what I'm sure they consider to be a loophole?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a state-by-state issue where some states are friendlier than others. We have legislation that's passed in 30 different states to protect the practice model specifically. Hmm. So the question is, if a doctor and patient are contracted directly with one another, and does the doctor become a risk-bearing entity, and should the doctor be regulated as an insurance company? And so, again, 30 states have weighed in on this issue, and 30 states have come down on the side that the doctor is not an insurance company and they're exempt from regulation. The issues that we tend to see more at the federal level, that's just in the tax treatment issues of it. So, you know, we've had probably about 7 years worth of debate in Congress and through multiple administrations at the White House as to how the IRS and Treasury Department will deem this relationship, which is sort of where the big, you know, the big special interests can sort of get involved and try to you know, shift the playing field basically against the practices that do it. But all in all, despite the fact that there's lots of headwinds across the country, you're still seeing massive uptick in growth of these practice models. And again, we're growing in all 50 states despite the obstacles that lie in the way. The challenge, of course, is then building the health plans around them that support them to provide the coverage for the what-ifs. But, you know, the fact that the system is so broken still has created immense amounts of opportunity and immense innovation. So you have things like health sharing ministries that have continued to grow and spread, and innovation is happening in those areas. You have immense innovation in the technology areas where you're now having lots of telemedicine, which is dramatically increasing access to specialty care, particularly in rural areas. And so that's something that's been incredibly important during the pandemic. These direct primary care practices have thrived during the pandemic, whereas the traditional fee-for-service primary care practices were nearly bankrupt by the federal response to these.
Right, because everybody had to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
everybody had to stay home. It took Medicare 3 months to recognize the invention of the telephone. So if your practice model depends upon physically seeing somebody in person in your office in order to bill their insurance to get paid, and then you've created an environment where people are unable or are afraid to leave their homes, you've essentially cut off the revenue supply of all of your outpatient physician practices,
sure,
which is exactly what happened last year.
Sure.
So our practices, the practices that operate under our model, they didn't need to wait 3 months for an insurance company to convene a committee to decide to pay for telehealth services. We just did it on day number one. Our patients didn't go out without their medications. We did parking lot visits. We did house calls. We did absolutely everything that we needed to do to make sure our patients got the access to care in a timely manner without being blocked out of the access to their physician.
So let's say a patient utilizes the telehealth or teledoc system. You get to talk to your doctor, and he says, "Okay, you need XYZ medication." Do they just do they mail you the medication at that point? How's that work?
So there are certainly, you know, individual telehealth systems, teledoc systems that you can do that. And typically, you know, they'll be able to send in a prescription into your local pharmacy if that's the service that you're using. If you're having a direct primary care practice where the person you're actually doing telehealth is your personal physician, then there are lots of options, anything from converting that, that telehealth visit into either a house call or in-office visits in order to do some, you know, testing that can't be done over the telephone. You know, there are times when physicians will just come in over the weekend and sew up lacerations or set broken bones. But the, you know, more traditional telehealth, systems that are drastically growing, you know, those can't be converted into in-person visits. So it is exclusively a technology visit. You, of course, you can do things over video and take pictures of rashes and so forth and you know, consult your doctor based upon the photos. Which again is a tremendous benefit for people that have not traditionally had great access to care because of, you know, whether the practices are spread out or it's a rural community and you just don't have physicians out there.
Yeah. Yeah. We've never had that technology before. So, again, this is a great reason for the government to kind of update their practice in Medicare, Medicaid.
Well, the crazy part is the VA has been using telehealth for a while. Mm-hmm. And have they, is it new that they've allowed private physicians to use that?
It's the issue with the private physicians doing telehealth is that the insurance traditionally didn't pay for it. What they would say is, well, if you're having a conversation with somebody on the phone, that should have been bundled into your previous office visit or your next office visit, so therefore we're not going to pay for it. And if they did pay for it, usually they paid pennies on the dollar for what the doctor would have made had they brought him into the office. And so
right.
If you do the visit over the telephone, you get paid $15. If you do it in person, you get paid $180. And so the incentive is to bring everybody into the office because that's the practice model. So during this pandemic, what Medicare did was they changed the rules and they said they're going to pay the same amount for a telehealth visit as they will for an in-person visit, which is great because that was necessary to keep the private practices alive. The problem is you created a lot of incentive for fraud and abuse within the telehealth system that we're going to have to sort of sort out as this goes along. But again, it created awareness of the ability for the telehealth services. It created demand for the services. And now that people are actually utilizing the service, they're realizing there's quite a bit of value in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing that I see like through the VA system, which is typically the poster child for not having government-run healthcare, works great if you just need one little thing. But if you're having a, you know, if you have something that requires, especially if you live in a rural area like we do and you need any kind of specialty stuff, it's a gauntlet. I mean, it's just a gauntlet for scheduling and everything else. But one of our clinics up here was without a psychiatrist and has been for, I don't know, 5 years now probably. They started using telehealth for that. And initially people really didn't like it, but it gave them access to doctors all over the place. And so I started hearing back from veterans. They were like, well, I kind of like it now. I found this new guy in, you know, Georgia or something. I mean, they're talking to people all over the place. Is telehealth in your type of model, are you able to bring in people from all over, or do you keep it kind of the normal people they would see?
Well, in my, you know, particular model, it's usually the telehealth specifically with your own patients, and it's a state-by-state level in terms of whether or not you can interact with patients out of state, you know, whether you need to be licensed in the practice where the physician is located or licensed in the practice where the patient's located. And if that's across state lines, every state treats that interaction differently.
Sure.
So that's a little bit tricky. And same thing with prescription of medications. If you're going across state lines, and the physician may not be licensed in the state where the prescription is going to, it creates issues where a doctor may be practicing without a license. But the important thing I think to note about the VA, first of all, what the VA is good at, they're very good at. You know, they do an excellent job in certain areas that just the private sector can't compete with. because they're able to put immense resources into things that the private sector probably would not find profitable. The problem is that when the VA is stressed to its limit, it has to go to the private sector to bail it out.
Yep.
And so when you create a single payer system, a one-size-fits-all government-run system, and the system is stretched to its max, there is no private sector to fall to. You just don't get access. And that's what you see in a lot of countries with socialized medicine, is you start creating waiting lists and rationing care and setting up rules who qualifies for services and who doesn't. Right now with the VA, they just give people a voucher and they give them, you know, the ability to go out and find their own doctors, and they get paid back for it.
Yeah, that kind of depends. And then, you know, they had a program for a while where the reimbursement was just not being done in a timely fashion, and I mean like a year and a half out on payment. And so then when they came back and said, well, hey, we're going to go back to a community care model, and you can use a physician in the community if we approve it. That's the other thing. You can't just go do it. They have to wave the magic wand and let you go do it. Then the physician has to say, okay, we'll take the reimbursement. But so many of them got burned during that time period. They were like, eh, we're not going to do that anymore. Like they already owe us $1 zillion. We're gonna just pass on that and deal with everybody else. But it becomes tough because you have to go through the primary care physician to get to everything. They're the gatekeeper, and I understand why they do that. I mean, you don't want everybody just running around willy nilly like a smorgasbord, going to all sorts of specialists. But it puts a huge amount of pressure on the primary care system.
It does, and there's also a tremendous amount of turnover in the primary care system within the VA, so it's hard to maintain any sort of continuity, so you'll never have the same doctor twice.
Right, which makes the gatekeeper model kind of stupid. I mean, because they're not really the gatekeeper. They don't really know that patient at all.
And so what ends up happening is those VA patients usually seek out people like me who provide the bulk of their primary care, and then if they need a prescription filled by the VA, typically, they'll take my prescription that I write, take it to their VA primary, and then the VA primary usually just rewrites the prescription that I've written. So now we're sort of duplicating services.
Yeah, because they can't take your prescription and have it filled by the VA. It has to come from one of their doctors. So yeah, it duplicates that every single time. That's not even optional, which is totally dumb.
But we create the access that the VA can't do.
So, correct.
You know, the VA really does encourage people to have private primaries, because the VA primaries certainly do not have the capacity in many communities to see people when they're sick. They don't have the capacity to get people in for acute illnesses. They don't have the capacity if things are generally not going well to see you same day or next day. You know, you can get in 2 or 3 weeks. That's not universal across the board, and I'm sure that's different in various pockets of the country, but in some areas it can take you 2 or 3 months to get into primary.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes longer. I mean, the one thing we did see was when Obamacare came in, I'm sure the rest of the country saw it too, you had a lot of doctors who said, yeah, you know what, I think I'm going to not be a doctor anymore. I'm just not doing this. And or they went to work for a hospital and became, you know, basically a hospitalist and stopped seeing private patients. So you had this huge crushing down of the people who would be family doctors. And so the private system, the VA system, all the systems are really, really short in that capacity.
Oh, yeah. A lot of new doctors weren't going into GP care.
That's true.
There's no money. You know, exactly.
Other interesting dynamic that's happening now is that, you know, because you've disincentivized people to go into primary care for a multitude of reasons. You know, I don't think people go into medical school because they want to be a gatekeeper. I mean, that's not something I know too many kids that dream of when they're children, is I want to be a gatekeeper when I grow up. But that's, you know, the position that many of the health plans and the government has sort of put you in. And of course it's the lowest paying physician specialty. So, you know, it's a sort of, you know, oath of poverty on a physician level to spend that kind of money into medical school and training and come out of $500,000 in debt and then to want to go into primary care. It just doesn't make a whole lot of financial sense for people. So it's creating sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where you have a shortage of primary care doctors. But you're building a system that's heavily reliant on primary care doctors in order to implement.
Yeah, I guess so that's kind of kind of where I was going with that is, yeah, you need them more than ever, but you've disincentivized people to go into that field. So where are those folks going to come from? We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to hear your guess on maybe how we fix that or get out of that.
Yeah, how do we cut the bureaucracy and kind of upgrade our our system to take advantage of
stop the train wreck?
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us, Bill.
Oh, .us, yeah, sorry.
I told him the tens you left me. I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could it take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain? Will it ease the pain? Will it help to pacify my brain?
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes.
Pretty good doctor music out there.
Yeah.
I always like doctor shows. I'm like, ooh, got a lot of doctor music. It's kind of fun. So how do you think we're getting out of the train wreck of no primary physicians and the really the, you know, you don't have much of a farm team at this point? Like, I know I have a niece who would have gone to medical school, and then she kind of looked at the cost of going to medical school and the cost of going to physician assistant school, the amount of time it would take, the debt she'd walk away with, and opted for physician assistant, which is too bad because she's really, really smart. She would have been a great doctor.
Well, she's a great physician. She'll be a great physician assistant. And so we need great physician assistants. Yeah, so that's an area that's rather controversial.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I think a lot of people will say, well, you know, primary care doctors really are probably overtrained. You really don't need that degree of training to do primary care medicine. So, you know, just a physician assistant really unsupervised probably could do primary care, and a nurse practitioner unsupervised probably can do primary care, because primary care is easy mostly if it's, you know, you're just gonna basically doing basic stuff, treating stuffy noses, and everything else goes out to specialists. And in the model that's been built, where the doctors are the primary care providers are all so darn busy that they basically are practicing checkbook, you know, checkbox medicine, just clicking boxes and doing whatever they're told, and every visit is so high-paced and pressured that you really don't have time to do anything other than refer patients out for every single little thing. Then it does create a system where pretty much anybody with any degree of training really could do primary care medicine because you're not really practicing medicine at that point. And so, you know, there's a big push in many parts of the country to say, let's let, you know, people go into primary care without supervision, regardless of their level of training. That in my circles is, again, it's a rather controversial thing because, you know, our general thought is that if you actually stop the bureaucracy and actually gave the physicians more time to practice medicine, that much of the stuff that is sent away is not sent away because the doctor is not capable of taking care of it. It's simply because the doctor doesn't have the time. But given the time, the doctor doesn't need to refer out all the diabetes for management. The doctor doesn't need to refer out the rheumatological conditions, the rheumatoid arthritis. All that stuff can be managed at the primary care level. It's only the most complex stuff that really needs to go. So I think it's important to have
that's your detective, though. See, like, I always have weird things, and so I count on my primary care doctor to be a good detective and always be picking up clues. And like Bill's primary care doctor, yeah, he referred him out for a, what do you call it, treadmill thing.
Yeah.
And just he
stress
wasn't,
test.
Yeah, he was fine. He wasn't sick.
Yeah, wasn't
he
sick.
Wasn't having any
no
stuff.
Symptoms.
No, he goes out for his little treadmill thing and winds up with 7 heart stents because he had 2 major blockages. Surprise!
And we used to do stress tests in our office until Medicare stopped paying for it. Mm. You know, as primary care physicians, we had training in doing stress tests, so it didn't require a referral out to the cardiologist to do that. That was certainly within the realm of a primary care. You know, if you have basically one of the number one causes of death in the country is heart disease, and your primary care doctor doesn't have the ability to do a stress test to detect that, if it requires a referral for it, again, you're creating obstacles to the delivery of care. And in no way is this you know, what I said meant to be derogatory to the professionals that are physician assistants and nurse practitioners.
Well,
I mean,
no, but
exceptional training there.
Yeah, there are tons of people who get really mad too. You know, I had to pay full fare, and I didn't even see the doctor. You know, I'd see some assistant. There are a lot of people who don't consider that to be a doctor visit.
Right. But in a market-based system where people are open with their training and their credentials and backgrounds, there is a place for every single, you know, every single one of these healthcare professionals to practice, you know, you know, because there are patients that are more than happy to see a physician assistant, would rather see a physician assistant than a doctor. They would feel they're more personable, better trained, and, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think all of these things, you know, increase access to care in the right setting with the right training and the right supervision, I think are good. And the question I get a lot is, you know, so what's the solution to healthcare.
Exactly. That was my next question.
Bill was going to wait to sandbag you in the last 2 minutes.
Well, no. What can we do to streamline the bureaucracy? Because, as you said in your article, you know, with new technologies and so forth coming out, a lot of these healthcare plans don't even pay for it. So we really still don't have access to the top. Medical care, I mean, if you can't pay for it, you're not going to get it. So, I mean, what's the solution there?
Yeah, so that's the thing, is there's not a solution. The good news is there's so much innovation happening right now. There are 1,000 solutions, and they're all happening simultaneously. But once the government puts their thumb on the scale and picks winners and losers in this process, you've stymied all innovation, and everything comes to a screeching halt.
Sure.
And so, you know, you're about to see this happen when, you know, the government's about to take over vision through this budget process they're working on. They're about to take over dental. They're about to take over hearing services. But I think you're going to see the most profound change is in vision. Because right now you can go on the internet, you can order your glasses, you can get 10 different kinds of frames, you can get progressive lenses, you can get funky colors and shapes and sizes until the government comes in and takes over. And once they do that, it's a one-size-fits-all approach. You get what you get, you don't throw a fit. And they will tell you what you can get, when you can get it, how many you can get, and how much they're going to pay for it. And beyond that, you know, they are essentially about to take over an entire industry that probably is not really consenting to the takeover by the federal government.
Right.
And so you will shut down all of the innovation that's happening within the vision industry.
Yeah.
So that's happening real time right in front of our eyes, and especially not even in front of our eyes. It's happening in backroom deals.
But there are
so many things that are happening. As long as, you know, the best thing the government can do right now is step out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, because pretty much everything they touch, as we've already said, you know, makes it cost more, makes it less efficient.
Sure. And, you know, when you talk about price, you know, especially in today's environment, major factor. I mean, people are going to look at, say, eyeglasses and say, you know, I know I need new glasses, but I don't have $600 or $800 before the process is all done to pay for a pair of glasses. So forget it. I'll just keep what I have or do without. So you're basically getting cut out of the process.
You are, or if you break your glasses and the government's going to say, I'm sorry, you already had your glasses this year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, I want progressive lenses. I'm sorry, you can only have bifocals. You know, your plan doesn't pay for progressive lenses. I mean, you know, that's just not offered. You know, you want the high-end fashion frames? I'm sorry, you know, look at the frames that are dispensed by the Army. Those are your options.
Yeah.
You can have any color you want as long as it's black.
As long as you want to look like you just jumped out of the casting for Nerds. Yeah.
Comes with a roll of white tape.
That's what I picture. It's like, cause that's, you know, that's what happened like in the Soviet Union. I mean, they had, I realize you don't wear glasses on your feet, but I mean, there's shoe stores. They had shoe stores for right, shoes that go on your right foot and shoes that go on your left foot. And, you know, good luck if you could find them that match.
Really?
Yeah, all the right shoes were over here and all the left shoes were over there. They were not sold as pairs. It's like, so, and you got to stand in a really long line about, for both.
You know, about, you know, expanding access to primary care and fixing those issues. If you make primary care an attractive specialty, attractive in the work setting, attractive in the satisfaction of the career, the ability to actually practice medicine like you wanted to practice medicine, and you make it financially rewarding as well, that will draw more people into the field, and that's what the direct primary care model does. Mm-hmm. If you decrease the regulatory burden on the practice, and instead of spending most of your time filling out paperwork and fighting with insurance companies, you're providing patient care, you've effectively doubled the number of patient interactions that you can have, because you're no longer treating the bureaucracy, you're treating the patient. So you've effectively doubled the number of primary care workforce within that. If you start building in the efficiencies of the technology platforms and telemedicine services, what might take somebody a half a day out of their work schedule to see a doctor can be accomplished in 3 minutes over a technology visit. So you can actually access more patients. A virtual primary care doctor can have a panel of 10,000 patients and take care of them all perfectly well.
Wow.
In our system, why can't an endocrinologist be a primary care doctor for a diabetes patient? Why can't the cardiologist be the primary doctor for a congestive heart failure patient, or a pulmonologist be a primary doctor for an asthma patient or an emphysema patient? These are the sort of things that once you take away the complexities of our billing structure and how the system is designed, it completely opens up possibilities and it eliminates all the bottlenecks, and this problem simply solves itself.
Are there other countries that are implementing this program, or is this something that's kind of new to the U.S.?
The National Health Service is starting to implement something like this because of the problems that they have over in England. I'd say that the country that's probably most closely resembles this model is probably Singapore, where almost everything in Singapore is a cash transaction. For routine services, primary care is all cash. Most all your specialty care is cash. And all the high-end stuff is done through insurance, which is, you know, public-private partnership,
right,
to offer coverage for hospitalizations and surgeries, major surgeries and so forth.
Hmm. Well, shoot, that was a fast hour.
Yeah, it worked.
That was a very fast hour. Dr. Lee Gross has been our guest this hour, talking about the public option is the wrong approach to healthcare reform. Thank you, Doctor, for being with us, and I hope people will go read your article. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, just stand.